Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, that was disappointing, wasn't it? A mediocre jobs day once again, my friends. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 6th of September. Great to have you with us for the podcast today. And we were greeted this morning, as we traditionally are on the first Friday of the month, by what is officially called by the Bureau of Labor Statistics the Employment Situation Summary. I will use a less grand term to sum it up, lame. We added a not really adequate 169,000 new jobs in August. The unemployment rate ticked down a 10% to 7.3%. And when you dig down, it gets worse. The number of jobs added in June and July were revised down, and the unemployment rate is coming down. Mostly, boy, that's a lot of downs, right? It's coming down mostly because not as many people are looking for work. In point of fact, fewer Americans were working in August than they were in July. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is going to sort all of this out for us.
So we had more jobs last month, 169,000 more, and fewer Americans who had jobs last month, 115,000 fewer.
Wow, that's a weird month, certainly applies here.
Doug Handler at IHS Global Insight says this sort of weirdness happens because the numbers come from different places. In what's called the household survey, 60,000 households are asked how many adults were working last month. The data crunchers extrapolate to the whole workforce. That's how they estimate the number of people with jobs. In what's called the establishment survey, 500,000 business and government workplaces are asked how many people were on the payroll. That's how they estimate the number of new jobs. So in this morning's report on both surveys, the job numbers were down and up, depending.
It is just sort of sampling noise.
Tom Nardone at the Bureau of Labor Statistics says each survey has a margin of error.
In the case of the household survey, it's nearly 400,000. So might sound odd, but the minus 115 is not statistically different from the number from the payroll survey.
Okay, it does sound really odd. But the point is, Nardone says, when you look over a whole year, the two surveys tend to even out and agree, which the Federal Reserve already knows as it decides whether the job market's strong enough to survive a cutback in monetary stimulus, says John Canale at LPL Financial.
And if you put it all together, the economy is adding jobs at a relatively modest pace.
That's a story that's been consistent since the recovery began. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This is one of those jobs reports, and this is one of those weeks where a minute and a half just isn't going to do it. So we are going to go a little bit longer here. Here to do that with us are Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. He is at Marketplace East, our New York studios. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government is in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Cardiff, what do you think? Was I too strong with lame?
Not too strong at all. There really wasn't a whole lot in this jobs report to be happy about. The revisions downward were especially worrying. But you know what really makes it bad isn't even the headline number, right? That 169,000. Yeah. It's that we know that support, the pace of support from the Federal Reserve is set to slow down soon, and there's no other kind of help coming. Well, the government's certainly not going to help, and if anything, it's been actively hurting. So this is a really bad report. I don't see anything to cheer about.
All right, let's talk about that pace of support, Neela. This is that thing called quantitative easing, the Fed's bond buying program, $85 billion. We've all heard those statistics. It is supposed to, or we all widely believe that the Fed's going to start tapering it off next month or maybe even this month. Is this going to change that at all?
No, it doesn't have to, Kai. The Fed has made two commitments so far. It said that it's going to start tapering by the end of the year, mm-hmm. but it won't do so until the labor market is strong enough. What this jobs report tells us is that the labor market is just not there's too much uncertainty, and it's not strong enough for a tapering path to be anything but bumpy. It will not be smooth. And we can expect there might be pauses, even reversals in tapering. It won't be a smooth path to the end of the stimulus
program. Are you kidding me? You think they're going to reverse the taper? I can't even believe this is like metaphysics here. They're going to reverse the taper. The markets, Cardiff, would go bananas.
It would be weird, but it can't be ruled out. And one of the reasons why is that Bernanke and the Federal Reserve haven't done a good job of communicating exactly how it is that they're going to taper. Yeah. They haven't specifically tied it to conditions in the economy and in the market. They've just given a little bit of guidance. So it's very possible, especially when you consider that Bernanke's term as chairman is set to end in January of next year. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other members of the board that are going to be changing positions. So I think it's very possible that we really don't know what's going to happen in the near term. It's very uncertain. I think Neela makes a great point.
Man, that's crazy. That people are going to go bonkers, and you heard it here first. All right, well, speaking of, you know, things that are going to happen this fall, Neela, we're going to have a new chairman of the Fed named at some point. There are going to be votes on the debt limit and funding the government. And now this week, the past 2 weeks, all this Syria stuff. How much does what's happening with Syria, not the politics of it, but the Washington-ness of it, affect what's going to go on in the economy and things that, that the three of us, you know, cover?
You know, the projections of what a potential Syrian attack would be is about $1 billion. That's not a lot of money when you look at the entire government budget. So in terms of what is expected for the economy, just the numbers, you don't see a big effect. But the effect in terms of the psychological damage, mm-hmm. the uncertainty, of course, we're going to see that read into the economy. And also what happens on Capitol Hill. There's a lot going on this month, Kai. We still have to fund the government, for instance. We have 9 days to do that after Congress gets back in session next week. We got to figure out the debt ceiling in mid-October. And on top of this, we have Obamacare and mm-hmm. Syria, two very contentious issues in Congress right now.
I love the way you say we, like the three of us are going to do anything about it.
Well, you know, I like to feel like some kind of personal involvement in these things.
Cardiff, how ugly do you think this fall is going to be? You roll it all into one big ball of wax?
Oh, who knows? I mean, the Syria question is crucial. There's also the direct effect of oil markets. It's already had a little bit of an effect there. That could get worse. Yeah. But, I mean, it all comes down to what Neela said. And I'm usually skeptical of these personality-driven stories. I tend to think there's a lot of posturing there, and a lot of politicians generally just vote their interest. But it's not unimaginable to think that some of these politicians are going to see a weakened president, and they're going to start, you know, staking a stronger claim to some of their other issues, and they're going to push harder, which just means more gridlock. So it's something to worry about.
Curiouser and curiouser. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. See you guys.
Thank you,
Kai.
Have a great weekend.
You too. On Wall Street today, honestly, traders didn't know what the heck to do. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You know that sturdy-looking padlock you see on your internet browser when you go to a secure web page? It might not be quite as sturdy as you or any of us actually thought. The latest from the Edward Snowden files shows that the National Security Agency can peek inside much of the internet traffic that we thought was encrypted. It turns out the NSA has a secret key to that padlock, sometimes a key provided by tech companies themselves. So what are businesses to do about that? Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the story.
First off, if a CEO is upset about NSA spies rifling through corporate data, tough. Companies can complain to Congress, but never outfox the NSA. Thomas Tachek of the corporate security firm Matizano says companies would go broke trying to match the NSA's untold billions.
China breaking into networks, and to a much greater extent, criminals breaking into networks, is definitely something that companies spend a lot of money on. I don't think companies are going to spend money very differently based on the NSA disclosures.
But that doesn't mean they're not freaked out. Mike Janke, CEO of encryption company Silent Circle, says clients, some of America's biggest companies, have been calling like crazy.
The number one concern we hear over the last 12 hours is the revelation that the NSA is in the back door of the hardware.
He's referring to news the NSA got U.S. tech firms to install so-called back doors in their products, secret features that allow the NSA in. Think of it like a pet door. It's only supposed to be for your dog. But if a raccoon finds it, he'll crawl inside that back door and make a real mess of your kitchen.
The problem is it can get other people access to information. So it's very worrisome.
Johns Hopkins encryption researcher Matthew Green says that has companies questioning their technology.
How can we, you know, buy products that we can trust? Unfortunately, that's a very bad thing for the U.S. tech industry, which is probably the biggest impact of these reports.
That could mean American tech companies lose business and jobs to foreign firms. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We hear all the time about hacking, bad guys exposing our digital vulnerabilities with amazing technical know-how. Sometimes people get hacked, sometimes companies do, but you know what? It's not always whiz-bang high-tech. Sometimes it's just good old interpersonal manipulation. Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains.
Once upon a time, not too long ago, they called them con artists. They ran scams. They were on the take. They ripped you off, but not by gunpoint or force, but by winning your trust and confidence. In the movies, con men look like Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11.
Okay, I ask you a question. You have to think of the answer. Where do you look? You look down, they know you're lying. And up, they know you don't know the truth. He's got to like you and then forget you the moment you've left his sight.
Well, the cons moved online. Only today, cybersecurity experts don't call them con artists. They call them social engineers because they break into computer systems not by hacking the technology, but by hacking humans.
You know, you look back at the original con men, the principles are the same. But now it happens instantaneously almost because of the web.
Chris Hadnegi is the author of Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. He says in the old days, con men might have spent weeks or even months getting your phone number, finding out where you work, who your friends are, where you hang out. These days, social engineers can get that information in days or hours by scouring the web. And unlike the old days, increasingly, social engineers are targeting businesses.
When we hear these attacks, we always focus on the tech piece. But there was an interview done with an ex-Anonymous member. Her nickname was Sparky Blaze.
Anonymous is a loose collective of cyber hacktivists who've hacked into PayPal, Visa, and Sony.
She said that during her time with Anonymous, every attack that they launched against every company involved some form of social engineering.
He says it's not just Anonymous. Look at the Coca-Cola hack. In that one, social engineers got an executive to click on an email that was made to look like it was from Coke's CEO.
He opened it, it crashed, said, I guess it's not a good file, and ignored it. Well, that file was laden with malware, and they were able to infiltrate Coca-Cola's network.
Nobody knows what the hackers took or how much damage was done. Some suspect corporate espionage. But Coca-Cola's been very mum on the matter. And Hagenini gets it. He says companies are in a pickle.
See, if I tell you that my company was infiltrated because there was this gaping hole in one of my pieces of software, and then I say, oh, we patched it, now you feel secure.
But if I say, hey, one of our employees got duped and we got hacked, what's the patch for human error? In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, economic growth on the Great Plains.
If you stay the way you are, nothing ever changes, and you fall back position. If you're not growing, you're going backwards.
Our series, American Futures, continues. That's straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Much early ado turned out to be nothing. The Dow Industrials is up, and then it was down, and then it finished down to 10%, 14 points, closed at 14,922. The NASDAQ added 1 point. We'll call that flat, 3660. The S&P 500 also flat, 1655. For the week, things were a little more exciting. The Dow gained 0.8%. The NASDAQ pushed ahead 2%. The S&P 500 picked up 1.4%. Now, for the rumor mill, rumor number one, Amazon is going to start giving away smartphones. That tidbit helps send the online giant shares up 0.5%. Rumor number two, Apple will cut a deal with China's biggest mobile carrier to sell cheap iPhones. Apple also climbed 0.5%. Here's my favorite. Ford CEO Alan Mulally, this is a rumor now, will leave the carmaker early to head up Microsoft. Yeah, I don't know. Ford down 1.75% today. Microsoft down 0.25% as well. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for July. Congress returns from its August recess. And on September 9th, 1776, the Continental Congress renamed the United Colonies the United States. And the rest is history. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Opening a new restaurant is a notoriously risky proposition. Margins are tight, customers are fickle. Eating out is, after all, a disposable income kind of thing. So what if you, budding restaurateur that you are, want to hedge your bets a little bit? What if you want to open a new, permanent, sit-down place but don't want to deal with the hassle of a new lease and new staff, new plates and new bathrooms? From Portland, Oregon, Dina Pritchip reports.
Block and Tackle is not your usual fish and chips seafood restaurant. The corn comes with tarragon aioli, and the oyster shooter has smoked tomato. But it's still a pretty laid-back neighborhood joint. And when Stephanie Cranley's husband took her there for their 8th anniversary, she was not impressed.
My first reaction was, it's a little too casual for our anniversary.
But then the hostess took Cranley and her husband Jack to their table.
They led us through the first restaurant to the back door, and it's like being led into like a secret society.
That's because the back room of this restaurant is a whole nother restaurant. It's called Row, and it's a quiet, intimate restaurant, definitely worthy of an anniversary dinner. Chef Trent Pierce runs both places.
Because of everything that has happened in the last decade, really, as far as restaurants are concerned and just the economy and everything, I think it really made sense to do something on a much smaller scale.
Instead of signing a new lease, Pierce just overhauled the back room of his existing restaurant. It cost roughly $20,000, about $75,000 less than opening a new place. It's something chefs across the country are exploring.
If we were doing this exact concept in its own standalone, I would say we'd probably charge about 10 to 15% more than what we're charging now.
Like many restaurants within restaurants, Row is small, just 26 seats. And it's much more fine dining. The set menu starts at $65 compared to an $8 bowl of chowder out front. But Pierce says it's surprisingly not where the money is.
Every restaurant is a volume business, no matter what. So you have to really be destroying it in terms of how many people that you're doing in order to be killing it in profit.
Which begs the question, why do chefs go through the trouble of creating a restaurant within a restaurant if they're not going to make much money?
What happens back here is very personal cuisine. It's fine dining. It's an experience is kind of what you're paying for. You're not just going out to get full.
And if this experience comes with the feel of a secret society, especially one that saves the chef $75,000, all the better. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Dina Pritchup for Marketplace.
Procter & Gamble is a big company that makes a lot of the little things that we use every day. Paper towels, detergents, razor blades. Now it's leading the charge in offering upscale versions of some of those everyday products, from specially embossed paper towels to designer tampons and dishwashing detergent. We asked Marketplace's Chrissy Clark to find out whether that might actually work.
The word of the moment, bifurcation. That's industry lingo for a company selling some products to high-end customers, others to bargain hunters. The American middle class is shrinking, the extremes getting bigger. So that word is on the minds and lips of consumer industry experts everywhere.
Bifurcation.
Bifurcating.
Bifurcating.
Bifurcation is behind Procter & Gamble's push into the high-end market, according to Milton Pedraza with the Luxury Institute, a research firm.
The world is bifurcating into the dollar stores and the Saks Fifth Avenues of the world.
So P&G, maker of middle-of-the-road brands like Tide and Crest, is scrambling. Now it's offering bookend lines. On the one end, cheaper, stripped-down products like Bounty Basic paper towels. On the other, Bounty Duratowel and Radiant tampons. And it just might work, says Pedraza.
Toyota did it with Lexus.
But Alex Smith, a consumer trends consultant, has a warning.
The recession made everyone, even higher income individuals, think more critically about the things that they buy and not sort of just fall into the indulgence for indulgence sake trap.
Outside a supermarket in downtown LA, I talked to Jessica Czar and Matt Chisholm, young professionals who both make good money, the perfect targets, theoretically. So were they impressed with the Radiant tampons and the Platinum dishwasher soap?
I would never buy it. I don't know what radiant means, if it's like metallic and shiny, but
you're going to dispose of this stuff.
These are just basic staples that are disposable.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, it took Toyota 10 years to get people into the idea of spending money on a Lexus. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
We started a new series this week with Jim Fallows from The Atlantic and his wife, Deb. It's a road trip of sorts. They fly around the country in their own small plane, one engine, four seats. We join them along the way in a project we're calling American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Seabolt's approach, Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo. We've got Tango for landing.
Flying a plane across the country is a pretty good way to figure out what America and the American economy look like right now. Our first stop is Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And one way to get a sense of all the economic change there over the past couple of decades is to start downtown pretty early in the day, too.
Now, why, you might properly ask, are we up at 10 minutes to 7 on a Friday morning in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? Well, I'll tell you why. Because there's a new coffee shop. And we're just going to stick our heads in and see what's going on.
What was going on was a dude sitting right outside the still locked door. He'd brought his own chair, basically camping out.
I'm Dave Thomason.
You live here in Sioux Falls, obviously?
Yes, I do.
Now tell me again why you brought your chair to a coffee shop opening.
To be the first one here for the downtown location.
It's a place called Cafea. This is their second location, their first downtown. And when the doors finally opened right at 7 o'clock?
Oh, there we go.
Woohoo!
Well, cheers from the more than modest crowd that was there, because this was quite the place to be. It's one of the newest businesses in a town where not all that long ago.
This is a cornfield. This is all a cornfield across the street, all the way up to 57th Street, which we're talking 14, 15 blocks, either pasture or cornfields.
You remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember cornfields on 33rd Street. We're sitting on 70th right now.
Jeff Nelson's been selling real estate in Sioux Falls for 30 years. 30 years in which the city went from cornfields to subdivisions. One reason why that happened? Take a look at your credit card bill the next time it comes in the mail.
City comes in 1981 with the credit card business.
The city came out. They started training people. And all of a sudden, everybody saw that there were a lot of people that knew how to do credit cards. So more and more banks got into it. More and more came to Sioux Falls. And that credit card industry was good for Sioux Falls, and it's still very good for Sioux Falls.
Citibank came because in 1981, South Dakota got rid of the limits on interest rates that credit card companies could charge. More banks followed, and so did, naturally, bankers. They moved here from New York City with a whole lot of money to spend.
I think that just sold for probably in the 345, 350 area, but then these, you get down the street here, we're going to go 500 and up. All the way down around the corner, there's a million.
Million-dollar house in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Oh, lots of million-dollar houses in Sioux Falls. Lots of million-dollar houses.
What do you suppose, this is sort of counterfactual here, but what do you suppose Sioux Falls would be like today if city and the card companies had not come in 1981?
I'd like to think that we would be similar to what we are, but I don't know that I would. I don't know that I could say that. You know, there's that old story about the difference between Sioux City and Sioux Falls. And Sioux City was a little bit bigger than we were in the late 1970s, maybe 90,000 when we were at 75 or 80. We got city, but Sioux City never went that way. And now they're 85,000, and we're closer to 200.
If you had your druthers, would you see Sioux Falls get bigger, or would you just keep it the way it is? Thank you very much.
If you stay the way you are, nothing ever changes, and you fall back position. If you're not growing, you're going backwards. Sioux Falls is always going to get bigger, I think.
All that change goes back to what I said on Wednesday when we started this whole thing. Sioux Falls is, in some ways, the center of your economic universe. The interest rate on your credit card, the gas that's pumped into your cars, the food your kids eat at school, it all eventually comes back to us.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a thought or two about how we've been spending the week, because American Futures isn't your ordinary series. It's not a handful of stories on a single topic. It doesn't have a narrative arc the way editors like. It's more a collection of experiences. Jim and Deb Fallows and me, from time to time, are going to go out and look around. We're going to talk to people, and we're going to tell you what they tell us. And then by the end of it, maybe a year, maybe more from now, you'll have a pretty good sense of what America and the American economy look like. And so we leave you with this on a Friday afternoon. The best interview I did out in Sioux Falls, maybe Really, the best interview of all time.
Well, this happens to be Sylvia Henkin, 92 and a half years old, and I came here in 1944 as a young, bashful bride. This used to be sort of a one-business town. After Citibank, everybody wants to get in here, and I don't blame them. And I see it only for the better. We're not Little Sioux Falls anymore. We are internationally known. And I have relatives who live all over the country, and every once in a while I'll get a call. Oh, we heard about Sioux Falls on the television or something.
And then, well, she started to sing, Sylvia did.
I'm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's the finest city that I know. I love
a song that her late husband commissioned for the 100th anniversary of the city of Sioux Falls.
For here in South Dakota, you get more than your quota of friends who would never let you down. I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's my hometown. If I can't have fun, to hell with it.
Oh, man. What are you going to do with that except put it on the radio, right? All right, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM on a Friday. American Futures was produced by Bridget Bodner and Ethan Lindsay. It was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. He had help from Brendan Willard. We are going to move on from Sioux Falls, Marketplace, and the Fallows are. But American Futures lives online until we land again. We've got maps, Jim's blog from The Atlantic. The whole smash is at marketplace.org. Take a second while you're there to tell us where you think we ought to go next. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer of this production house. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you again on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.